Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's MolDX press briefing on Texas v. U.S. Oral Arguments, DACA. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you'll have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing star one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call may be recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn today's program over to President and General Counsel Thomas Sines. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. My name is Thomas Sines. I'm President and General Counsel of MolDX, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to this press briefing following oral argument before a panel of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals this morning in New Orleans regarding Texas versus United States. As you are all aware, Texas versus United States is a challenge filed in 2018 to the legality of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, an initiative put forward by the Obama administration in 2012. In this case, Texas and eight other states argue that DACA, implemented 6 years before the suit was filed, was nonetheless unlawful and should be removed. About a year ago, in July of 2021, District Court Judge Andrew Hanen granted summary judgment to the plaintiffs in this case. By granting summary judgment, he reached a conclusion that there were no undisputed facts required to make a decision that the plaintiff states were correct in their contention that DACA is unlawful. Immediately following that decision a year ago, three different parties filed appeals disputing Judge Hanen's conclusion. Those parties were the United States as defendant. Important to note that as of last year, it was a new United States defendant, namely the Biden administration. Throughout most of the case, the defendant was the Trump administration, which actually agreed with the plaintiffs about DACA's legality. In addition to the United States, two other parties filed appeals to the Fifth Circuit. One, intervening defendants who are DACA recipients, represented by MolDX, also filed an appeal, together with another intervener defendant, the state of New Jersey. After briefing, the case appeared this morning before a randomly selected panel of three judges from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Engelhardt, Judge Ho, and Judge Richmond. As those who heard the argument understand, there were presentations by all four of the parties, the plaintiffs, as well as the defendant, United States, the intervener, DACA recipients, and intervener, state of New Jersey. The arguments covered the key issues in the case, and they are three. First of all, standing, whether the state of Texas has proven an injury sufficient to enable it to go into federal court to challenge DACA and its continuation. Second, when DACA was implemented, were proper procedures under the Administrative Procedures Act followed by the Obama administration? And third, was the power to implement DACA and provide relief to hundreds of thousands of young immigrants raised in the United States and prepared to contribute through their labors, through their professional accomplishments to our society, whether that initiative was within the authority of President Obama? In addition, as you may have heard from the argument today, more recently, a fourth issue arose from recent Supreme Court decisions surrounding whether federal law prevented the implementation of an injunction nationwide against DACA, specifically whether the Immigration and Nationality Act restricts the ability of the federal court with respect to DACA and an injunction. The arguers today presented their arguments to the three-judge panel, which has now taken the case under submission. That means that they will prepare a decision and any dissent in the next weeks and months. There is no established timeline for when they must or will decide the case, but we do know that when a decision is rendered, it is likely that whichever side it finds itself in disagreement with the decision will then consider further action, either a request for a full hearing by the entire Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals or a petition to the Supreme Court to hear the case. Today on our briefing, we have four guests, and it is my pleasure to begin with those guests by introducing one of those who argued today before the three-judge panel, MALDEF's Vice President of Litigation, Nina Perales, who was representing those DACA recipients who intervened early in the case to defend DACA, recognizing that the Trump administration at the time would not put forward a vigorous defense at all. And now I'm happy to turn over to Nina Perales. Nina.
Thank you very much, Tom. My name is Nina Perales. I'm the Vice President of Litigation for MALDEF and one of the attorneys who argued this morning in the Fifth Circuit. MALDEF represents 18 DACA recipients who live around the United States. This group includes nurses, lawyers, students, office workers, teachers, and many more. And these 18 individual DACA recipients stepped forward to defend DACA because when this case was filed in the early summer of 2018, there was no argument by the part of the administration that DACA was legal. This case was filed by Texas and other conservative states against the Trump administration, which immediately agreed with the lawsuit. So with the law firm of Ropes and Gray and MALDEF, we stepped forward on behalf of the 18 DACA recipients to defend DACA in court. Since January of 2021, we have had the Biden administration now also defending DACA. So this morning's arguments, as Tom mentioned, were presented by three attorneys on our side. First, Brian Boynton for the United States, and his argument touched somewhat on this issue of whether Texas could bring the lawsuit, and then primarily focused on the fact that DACA is legal and that the administration has the legal ability to put it into effect. I went second in the argument and focused on what's called standing, which is the argument that Texas could not show any injuries flowing from having DACA recipients living in Texas, because the record in the case as it was developed shows that Texas suffers no harms or no injuries as a result of DACA recipients. In fact, DACA recipients make important contributions to the states that they live in. And so when I finished my argument, then the third arguer on our side, Jeremy Feigenbaum, went and argued on behalf of the state of New Jersey. We did have some questions from the bench, but primarily the judges were listening very carefully to the points that we were making. And then after we finished, the state of Texas stood up. They argued for about 10 minutes. And then after that, the last arguer was again Brian Boynton with the Department of Justice. And so some of the issues that the judges are going to be thinking about is whether Texas has shown injury such that this case should even go forward, and then maybe questions related to whether the judge down below properly issued his order or whether it needs to go back to him for further consideration, and then the panel may or may not reach the question of DACA's legality. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Nina. It is now my pleasure to turn it over to our partner at MALDEF in representing the courageous intervener defendant DACA recipients from the law firm of Ropes and Gray. It's now my pleasure to introduce Doug Hallward-Dreemeyer. Doug.
Thank you so much, Tom. Again, it's Doug Hallward Dreamer from Ropes and Gray. I just want to say how privileged we feel to have been working shoulder to shoulder with MLDEF ever since this lawsuit started. On the steps of the courthouse today, we heard from many of the DACA recipients, including our clients, who reminded us of their inspiring stories that call to mind the many generations before them that have come to the United States looking to build a better life for themselves and to contribute to their communities. And they have done that, and it's our privilege to be their voice alongside MLDEF in the courtroom as we were today. And I thought it was remarkable that Texas really had no response to the arguments that we were focusing on, that they could not show any injury from the implementation of DACA. They had not even attempted to show the same kind of injury that they had shown in an earlier case challenging an analogous memorandum. And, you know, that we think speaks volumes, because as Nina and Tom have said, these individuals here are contributing to and adding to our society, and there's no way in which their presence here has injured Texas. And we hope the court will see that as well. And we look forward to continuing to work with MLDEF in the months and perhaps even years to come in defending the DACA recipients and their ability to stay and work here. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. And it is now my pleasure to introduce a board member from MLDEF, but more important, a longstanding leader in the fight to provide relief to DACA recipients and other immigrants who came here as minors and have grown up here and contributed to, continue to contribute to, the betterment of American society and their individual communities. Someone who really needs no introduction, but is currently a leader with the Dream.us, the leading scholarship program for DACA recipients in the country. My pleasure to turn it over to Gabby Pacheco. Gabby?
Thank you, Tom. First, I want to say thank you. Thank you to the attorneys who today argued on behalf of our DACA community. I want to give a special thanks to MLDEF, their health counsels, and the incredible Nina Perales. Since 1968, MLDEF has been the nation's leading Latino legal civil rights organization. And today, I was so proud and grateful to be there standing with them. Sitting in the courtroom, there were dozens of DACA recipients. They watched and heard the arguments being made today. When the judges entered the room, we all stood up, and I got the opportunity to look back and look at some of the DACA recipients in the room. And their faces were of not just determination, but also anxiety and heartache. At the end, I had the opportunity to hug some of the DACA recipients. And I want to tell you that while there is still hope, determination, there is worrisome. I'm not an attorney, but what I heard in today's argument, I want to make sure that we reiterate. We are talking about a full decade of an extremely successful program. This lawsuit was brought years after this program was already in place. And the DACA community has relied for this program for now 10 years. I think it's really important to share that not only are the DACA recipients dependent, reliant of this program, but the communities they live in will also depend and rely on those people having DACA. More than 90% of recipients are working, including more than 340,000 workers deemed essential. Like Nina said, there are nurses, there are educators, there are firefighters, there are people with dreams and hopes. There are people that are working to put food on the table for their children and their families. And many of these DACA recipients are head of households. Many of them have children. Today, after the oral arguments, we heard a DACA recipient and also an intervener in this case that MolDef represents talk about the fact that she is now a grandmother. We're talking about generations and people that have real lives. We're talking about DACA recipients that have U.S.-born children that depend on them. This issue is not just about 600,000 lives. This is an American issue. This is about our community. This is about our country. And while the future of one of the most successful immigration programs is at risk, as we know it, we want to make sure to reiterate that DACA recipients belong here. And it is inhumane for a country to know of their existence and do nothing about their ability to live their fullest life. I think for us, this only heightens the sense of urgency of a legislative solution that would provide the ability for this community to obtain a path to citizenship. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Gabby. And our final speaker on this briefing before we turn to you all for questions, we are pleased to welcome the leader of United We Dream, the most important coalition of DACA recipients and others who are similarly situated in continuing to make important contributions to our country while our United States Senate refuses to recognize them with long-term relief. To comment on the importance of today's case and of DACA in general, please join me in welcoming Graysa Martinez-Rosa. Graysa.
Gracias, Tom. Good afternoon. Buenas tardes. My name is Graysa Martinez-Rosas. I'm a DACA recipient and serve as the executive director of United We Dream and United We Dream Action. With 1.2 million members, we are the nation's largest network of undocumented immigrant youth. And we're really proud to lead the Home Is Here campaign that delivered the historic DACA victory at the Supreme Court against Trump in 2020. I first want to extend my gratitude to Nina and to Tom Sines of MolDef and all the MolDef team, the litigators of New Jersey, and all the brave, courageous, unapologetic DACA recipients who have taken on this fight for us in the courts. Today, the litigators, immigrant young people, organizers, and allies made their voices heard outside of the New Orleans courtroom, as well as the hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients sharing their stories online, made their point super crystal clear. DACA is right, DACA is legal, and it benefits not only DACA recipients, but all the communities that we call home. DACA is proof that when we organize, we can win big. And today, DACA protects over 600,000 young people, like myself, from detention and deportation. But over its 10 years, it has helped over 800,000 young people finish school, apply for a work permit, open their own businesses, buy their first cars in their homes, raise their families and their children and grandchildren, and has supported families and communities and states to thrive. And DACA is one of the most successful immigration policies in nearly 40 years in this country. Yet DACA was meant to be a stopgap measure. It's too long-lasting a relief and a pathway to citizenship, not just for DACA recipients, but for all undocumented people. It has now been a decade of congressional inaction, and this inaction is the one that gets people like me detained and deported. DACA is our victory, yet it's not enough. DACA has been under attack since its inception. The forces working against us are not shy about what they want. They want to end DACA and put all immigrants on a path toward detention and deportation. Republican governors continue to deliberately use DACA as a political weapon and continue to politicize our court system. We will not stand by. We will not let them. This continued legal battle leaves the lives of DACA recipients, DACA-eligible youth, and their families with a threat of detention and deportation, loss of income, and so much more. Not only that, but there are over 80,000 DACA-eligible young people who applied for the program for the first time last year, but saw their applications frozen because of attacks from politicians who want to hurt us. There's also young undocumented people graduating high school right now that have no pathway forward and find themselves where I find myself 10 years ago, undocumented, afraid, and don't know what the future holds for them. This is what our fight is about, a fight to protect people, families, and communities across the country, a fight for our lives. We will continue to organize unapologetically with hope and love. We will continue to fight with this movement lawyers like the ones represented on this call. And we need our elected leaders, congressional Democrats and Republicans, President Biden, to do the same, to pass permanent legislation so that we are no longer living court case to court case. The time is now, our home is here, and we're here to stay. That's it.
Thank you, Grace. In a moment, I'll turn to you all for questions for any of our speakers, but I want to speak briefly about potential outcomes. As I mentioned before, the three-judge panel has no set timeline by which they must issue their decision. We do not expect any early decision. But whether it's a matter of weeks or months is really entirely up to the three judges on the panel that heard argument today. I want to note that there are three potential outcomes. First, the panel could decide to reverse the decision by Judge Hayman, concluding, as we confidently believe the law provides, that in fact DACA was a lawful exercise of presidential authority and ought to continue, both for renewals, applicants who already have DACA, and for potential new applicants for DACA. Second, as you may have heard argued today, the panel could decide to remand the case to Judge Hayman, concluding that he wrongly granted summary judgment. As I mentioned previously, summary judgment requires a conclusion that there are no undisputed matters of fact related to, in particular here, the issue of standing. We argued today that there are many disputed issues related to the purported injury put forward by the state of Texas, and that, in fact, Judge Hayman should not have granted summary judgment, but should have conducted a trial on the issue of standing, hearing from witnesses and receiving evidence from both sides about whether the injury is in fact traceable to DACA. If the panel were to remand, Judge Hayman would be required to hold a trial on the issue of standing and specifically the injuries put forward by Texas. The third potential outcome is that the panel could affirm the decision by Judge Hayman, agreeing with him both that Texas had standing and that DACA may not continue. Now, it's important to note that as Judge Hayman stayed his own decision, prevented it from being implemented with regard to current DACA recipients so that they could continue while this appeal is pending to apply for and receive renewals of their DACA. That would remain the case until a remedial hearing proceedings are held to determine if the panel were to uphold Judge Hayman's decision to determine how to implement that conclusion that DACA is unlawful. Therefore, we do not expect any precipitous or immediate ending of DACA for anyone who currently has DACA and work authorization. We do not expect that as a result of any decision by this panel. It would first have to be determined by the panel, or more likely, by the district court, how to implement a decision along those lines. In the meantime, of course, as I mentioned previously, any of these decisions could result in a request for further appellate action, either by the full en banc Fifth Circuit or by the United States Supreme Court. With that, I now turn to you all to see if there are questions for any of our speakers.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. You may remove yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Once again, that's star 1 to ask a question. We'll take our first question from Rafael Bernal with The Hill. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you all for having this, and it's good to hear all of you. Two quick questions. Is there any potential result where the federal government is allowed to start registering new DACA applicants? And, well, let's just stick with that question for now.
So, yes, if this panel were to reverse Judge Hanen's decision, then DACA would be determined to be lawful and could go forward. Under the Biden administration, that would include not just continuing to renew DACA for those who currently have it, but opening the program to processing and granting new DACA for application. Nina, would you like to add anything?
The only other thing that I would mention is that this case is happening against the backdrop of the Biden administration preparing to issue a regulation related to DACA eligible individuals. I understand this morning that that regulation, still in draft form, was sent on for legal review, which triggers, I think, an up to 90-day period for legal review. But there is also the possibility that we might see, separate and apart from the DACA litigation, a new regulation related to Dreamers as well.
Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else want to comment? Otherwise, we'll take the next question. Next question.
All right. Our next question comes from Camilo Montoya. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for doing this. If maybe Nina can address this question, I wanted to see if you could just explain your position on the government's request that if the court finds that some parts of DACA are illegal, then it should strike only those parts down and not the entirety of the program. What is your position on that, and what do you think the likelihood of that happening is?
Nina?
Tom, did you want to? Okay. Our position is that there is nothing to sever away in the DACA memorandum of 2012. DACA is deferred action, like other types of deferred action for other immigrants who are in different situations. And so there is no piece of it that should be carved away because it is lawful. You know, the states have pointed to work authorization as something that they particularly object to. But when people have deferred action, they're eligible to work not because of anything in the DACA memo, but because of regulations that have been around for decades that say if you're a recipient of deferred action, then you can apply and be considered for work authorization. So our position is that not only is DACA lawful, but it is entirely lawful, and there is no reason to sever off any piece of it as being problematic.
Thanks, and I just want to emphasize two things that Nina said. First, deferred action was not invented in 2012 with DACA. Deferred action has existed under our immigration laws going back decades, and indeed that presidential authority has been used by presidents of both parties to grant relief to particular subclasses of immigrants in the United States. DACA precipitated this challenge 6 years late in filing, largely as a result of politics, the politics of the Trump administration and the politics of the Texas administration. The second point I'd like to emphasize is that work authorization must go along with deferred action. As Nina said, this is through established regulatory process that long predates the 2012 initiation of DACA. And it makes sense if you think about it. You can't allow people deferred action, inviting and permitting them to stay in the United States without giving them the means to support themselves and their families. Failing to do so would create just the harms that the right wing always predicts, which is that people end up needing to depend on others. To prevent that, you have to provide work authorization when you provide deferred action, and that is our position. Anyone else like to add anything?
Yes, this is Gabby. And I think just on the practical matter, to add to what Tom is saying, we're talking about people who have relied and are relying on this work authorization to be able to work the teachers in kindergarten classrooms. We're talking about people that have car payments and mortgages. So I think it's really important that we look at this issue fairly, because the people who have DACA and have had DACA are, like I mentioned before, majority of them are working and have families that rely on the income that they are able to get by legally having the work authorization that they have received.
Anyone else? Okay, is there another question?
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. We will pause a moment for questions to queue. And we'll take our next question from Julian Aguilar with Texas Newsroom. Your line is open.
Thanks, y'all, and good afternoon, and thanks for having this call. Is there anybody that can just quickly recap the argument about the states lacking standing? I kind of missed a little bit on the audio, Ms. Perales. I don't know if that's in your wheelhouse, but I was just, you know, something briefly to summarize for my readers that might not understand that that issue.
Sure. I will turn to Nina Perales, because her argument today was devoted to the issue of standing, which we think is particularly tenuous with respect to Judge Hayman's decision. Nina?
Yeah, thanks, Julian. So the issue with standing, just to boil it down, is that federal courts are not allowed to hear cases unless the person that's bringing the case has suffered some kind of injury, something that they can be seen, something that can be measured, and that's called standing to sue. It's been our argument all along that Texas lacks standing to sue, and therefore we shouldn't even be having this lawsuit. Nobody should be hearing this lawsuit because Texas lacks standing. And the reason we say that is because Texas has never been able to identify a harm that resulted from DACA recipients in Texas. Texas was not able to point to a single dollar of education or social service spending that went to a DACA recipient. And similarly, Texas was unable to point to any problems that were created by DACA recipients working in the Texas economy. Because Texas has no evidence of harm, no evidence of injury, it lacks standing to sue, and the federal court is not allowed to hear this case.
Great. Thank you.
And I will just add that it's important to note that the injury, the concrete injury that is required for standing, must be proven to come from what you are challenging. That is to say, these are complicated issues. And Texas must prove, and at this stage, because summary judgment was granted, it had to prove on the basis of undisputed facts that not only were there costs, and as Nina's explained, they did not identify or prove any costs, but that any such costs are actually attributable to DACA itself and would be ameliorated were DACA to be eliminated. That's a complex set of showings that we do not believe Judge Hayman had sufficient undisputed evidence in front of him to reach a determination that Texas had standing when he issued his ruling a year ago. Anyone else like to add? Okay. Is there another question?
We'll take our next question from Diane Solis with the Dallas Morning News. Your line is now open.
Hi, everyone. Thank you again for this. My question is, Webb, if you could detail what a new regulation related to DREAMers from the Biden administration might look like, how it might pass legal muster this time, and whether it would be larger or smaller.
I can take
that. Anyone want to take that question? Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Teresa. Hola, hi Diane. So good to hear your voice.
Hi, Teresa.
You know, so it's not clear to us at this moment where the administration landed on the construction of the of the incoming final rule. What is true is that this is a response to, you know, wanting to ensure that they're finalizing the processes and like running it through the proper, through the steps that they thought were necessary. And, you know, we don't know the impact of that, what it could have. What we do know, though, is that from its inception, the DACA program has been legal. President Obama had full authority to be able to grant this program. Any new rule that would come out would be a restatement of that power that the executive office has. And, you know, we'll be looking very closely to see the questions that you asked. How does this open up opportunities for the 80,000 DACA recipients that are in waiting and frozen in USCIS to be able to move forward with their application? Does this address the hundreds of thousands of now high school graduates or young, undocumented young people that are left out of DACA? I think those are the questions that we'll all be looking for. We don't have a sense of timing as of yet, but we do expect it to come within the next couple of months or within the year. So those are what is clear, though, and one final thing that I'll add, especially connected to the last question, is that there is no legal or policy challenges that DACA as a program presents. What we are witnessing and what I am and the hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients are experiencing at this moment is the political attacks from an opposition that wants to gain political points and use our lives as a football. And what we are seeing in this moment is that we will no longer stand for that. We're calling on all members of Congress, all elected officials to take action at the state and local level, and that DACA is legal, and we're going to continue to fight for it until every single day, to the very last day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Grayson. Is there another question?
And we have a follow-up question from Rafael Bernal from The Hill.
Thank you. I didn't want to mix up this question with the other one. I know Judge Haynen has had some has been very politically active on immigration, so his judicial writings are not always they seem to have a certain bias. But I wanted to know if you learned anything from the recent MPP Supreme Court ruling. Especially from what Justices Roberts and Kavanaugh said about how the Biden administration can choose not to implement MPP or what the INA allows the Biden administration to do or not to do. Is there anything you learned from there that can be that you think offers a window into how conservative jurists, without the biases of a Haynen, would be looking at this DACA case?
So I will begin just by saying that we really didn't learn anything from a decision that should have been obvious. The president's authority in the realm of immigration enforcement in particular is quite broad. Now, there are limits to that authority, particularly when you start to violate the rights of immigrants and their family members, as we saw too often under the Trump administration. But if you are not trenching on the rights, human rights of folks, then the discretion of the president is quite broad. That means, in the case of MPP, that the Biden administration certainly had the ability to rescind the terrible policy of its predecessor. It also means that the Obama administration, like its predecessors from both parties, had the ability to decide to grant deferred action to those that it clearly deemed not enforcement priorities. So the bottom line is that the decision from the Supreme Court simply re-recognizes that the president's authority in the realm of immigration enforcement is broad, again, only limited by the rights of others. And since there are no rights of others involved here, the president Obama and now Biden's authority to grant deferred action is, we believe, quite clear within our laws. Nina, would you like to respond?
Yeah, the only thing I would add, in addition to what Tom said, is that there's also a smaller legal issue in the MPP case, which is that in the MPP case, you had a court who was trying to order the Department of Homeland Security to take certain action. And it can be very problematic under the separation of powers, right? We have the executive, we have the legislative, and we have the judicial branch. And so what we're starting to see with cases like MPP is the court imposing some limitations or some bumper guards, I guess is the way you put it, on judges who might want to order DHS to exercise its discretion in certain ways. And one of the things we saw in MPP was that the Supreme Court was saying that that was something that shouldn't be done. That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else want to respond?
Tom, this is Doug. I'll just add a quick word to what Nina and Tom have already said, and that is that I think we've seen over the past couple of years a number of decisions from the Supreme Court that are relevant to all of the issues in this case. The standard for a state to prove standing in a case like this, that it cannot be speculative, and that's exactly what Texas is trying to do here. The amount of discretion that the executive has on questions of immigration, and then the significant limits on the court's authority to order far-ranging relief on the basis of a party that comes to it with really nothing at stake. All of the primary issues that there are in this case have been touched upon by the Supreme Court over the last couple of years, and in each of those decisions in ways helpful to our arguments here. Texas, throughout this litigation, has tried to say that this is just a do-over of an earlier challenge that it made to the DAPA memorandum. And we've pointed out that there are important factual differences between the two. But even more important than that, the Supreme Court has been clarifying the law in a number of ways that that clarify that what Texas is trying to do here, it really has no business to do. It's trying to interfere with the president's conduct of immigration policy, which is afforded to the federal government under the Constitution. And that's why we hope to be successful here at the Fifth Circuit. But if we're not, we'll have to take it to the Supreme Court, because we think that those precedents are very helpful to us.
Thank you, Doug. Any other questions?
It appears we have no further questions at this time.
Great. Well, first of all, I want to thank all of our speakers, Nina Perales, Vice President of Litigation at MolDef, Doug Hallward-Dreemeyer, our pro bono co-counsel, Gabby Pacheco with TheDream.us, and Teresa Martinez-Rosas from United We Dream, for joining us to talk about today's argument. I also want to thank all of you for joining us, and I want to end by emphasizing one point. We do not know when this court will issue a decision. We do not know what that decision is likely to be. We believe confidently that Texas has not proven standing, and that if it had proven standing, that DACA is a lawful exercise of presidential authority. But all of this raises the broader question, which is why, as one of our speakers has mentioned, why our Congress has not acted to address this issue legislatively. We know that the problem is with the United States Senate, and specifically with the failure of any Republican senators to come forward and willingly allow debate, argument, and finally a vote on whether to enact legislative relief for DACA recipients and others who are similarly situated. We all hope that today's argument, while providing us some insight into what may happen in the future in this legal case, we all hope that this argument is an occasion for all of us to once more ask and demand that our U.S. Senate, and specifically Republican senators, do their duty by allowing debate and a vote on permanent legislative relief for DACA recipients and others who are in similar circumstances. There is simply no longer any excuse
for our senators to be derelict in their duties, to neglect national security by refusing to act to protect the contributions being made by hundreds of thousands, actually millions of immigrants who deserve full protection for all of their contributions to our country, in particular through our most recent difficulties under the pandemic. This lawsuit should remind everyone that there are supermajorities of both parties across our country who support providing relief to these immigrants, and it's more than time for the Senate to do its duty. Thank you all for joining us. Have a terrific day.